So we'll go around and say names, starting with Tokyo.
Bob.
Myoju.
Mark.
Bruce.
Jim.
Hone.
Janelle.
Yeshe.
Zach.
Dave.
Mark.
Robin.
Rick.
Okay, we don't really have that much going on in June, but Tuesdays, the parents meet and greet. The 15th is the poetry group, which is at 10 o'clock, close to noon. And then on the 22nd, it's the following Saturday, is the book group. I think you're still studying homeschool though, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And next Sunday, because it's still not on that calendar, but next Sunday the talk will be by Diana Cation Saltoon Briggs, who is probably been practicing Zen as long as I've been alive. She was also my Japanese tea ceremony teacher. Oh, it is on already. Okay. And she's an author. She recently wrote a book, Wife Just Let Go, kind of a memoir reflection, somewhat poetic treatment of her. Her husband died probably a year and a half ago, maybe. Maybe a little longer, I'm not sure, of Alzheimer's. So it's kind of, their reflections as, and in some of his writings as he's, more and more suffering from dementia. And he had been a writer and poet and was, losing his touch with words. I don't know, it's just really, I've heard great things about it. I read part of it myself. And so she'll be talking somewhat about that. And she has a magical quality about her that I feel like when she speaks that she just draws you into Diana land. It's like you just go into a different kind of zone, and she just really totally embodies the Zen saying every day is a good day. So
is she from here, from
Portland? Yes, she's lived in this area for, I think they were originally from out east, but they've been here like 30 years at least. So, and then just recently, she moved to a retirement community in Hawaii. So, she's just actually, it's a visit back, and we had set up this talk that she could come and give. All right. And also keep an eye out in the newsletter, and on the website there are some guest speakers coming in July. One of the first Sundays it'll be Rinzon Pichovnik from the local No Rank Zendo or Rinzai Zen Center. He's come before. And then the third Sunday was going to be Joshin Clay.
Oh,
so
nice.
From Dharma Rain.
Should we tell about the summer party now so people put it on their calendar?
Sure.
It's on the 13th, right?
Is it on
July?
Of July 13th. Okay. And right now it just looks like a potluck, right?
Right.
Okay.
Maybe we'll change that.
Yeah. Send me a reminder about that. Mm-hmm. So our July 13th potluck will actually be, and where is it going to be?
At my house.
At Myoju's house. And because the weather will presumably be nice, we'll be mostly outside and just make it kind of a prolonged party.
When is it?
Your
time?
It's July 13th.
Midday?
Yes. Right? Is it going to be a midday thing or is it going to be a later?
12 to 2. Mm,
because I have awakening to whiteness at 3 to 5.
Are you serious?
On the 13th.
Oh, no.
July 13th?
Oh, well.
Is that the second Saturday?
Yeah, we may have had to double schedule like that. So we could maybe just have it after. Maybe we could have it be more of a dinner thing.
I think so. Because 12 to 2 is too short. And
Yeah, and you don't want to. Yeah. So then we could maybe do it a potluck dinner gathering party thing.
What time does the awakening to whiteness?
It ends at 5. I mean, definitely by 5.
So make it at 6 or something.
Yeah.
All right,
so stay tuned about a summer party. Now, Shintai recommended, did you have another announcement? Okay.
Yeah, I just, I'll be making this pitch, I'm for more people to be greeters and openers and closers. So if you're interested, let me know. You get to, greeting means being a guest master where any new people who come in, you welcome and show them around a little bit. And the openers put out everything, the tea things and the washing outfit, the washing setup. And the closers take all that stuff down. Yes.
And so you just have to get here a half an hour early, or sometimes you're staying 20 minutes late. And I don't know, some people can probably speak up. It is a great way to get yourself to come. You know, just like no question, now you have to go because you're signed up to be an opener or a closer or whatever.
It's a good way to get involved, too.
Yeah.
So, and it's pretty
easy. And Robin says it's pretty easy, so.
But if there's enough people, then you don't have to do it very often. And I try to accommodate when you can come, when you can. You know, your special needs.
Shintai suggested, so this is one of the things I'm looking forward to. She's not doing Thursdays anymore, which is sad, but she's going to be coming more regularly. She's going to kind of take June off, but then she's going to be trying to attend most Sundays and giving a Dharma talk once a month and stuff like that. So we're going to kind of collaborate on what we have a little more than trying to add a new program. And one of the things I'm really looking forward to is having her help on incorporating more traditional forms into our practice, which, I mean, to some extent, this is just an evolution from a group. You know, we meet, twice a month in a borrowed space in a church. And, you know, I mean, there, when you're doing big formal things with a group, you know, if it's only three people listening to this Dharma talk, it would seem kind of weird for me to do something formal. But I feel like we're at this point. So she suggested we incorporate, so now after we've done this, when we're doing a Dharma talk, I'm going to get up and offer incense and sit back down, and then I will do a little opening statement, and then when we're done, rather than just kind of like, all right, that's it, I will go up and do a closing offering. So. How much to the Buddha, how much to the Dharma, how much to the Sangha. So today, I'm continuing on our exploration of my 9 fields of Zen practice. Go ahead and hand these out. So as many of you know, I have been working on this comprehensive list of all the aspects of Zen practice probably since I began practicing 25 years ago, because I just have a mind that likes to put things into categories and lists. So I feel like just about anything that I can think of in terms of practice, in terms of important aspects of Zen practice, comes to mind, and then now I can think of where it fits in these nine fields. And today we're going to be talking about two of them, precepts, which I'm not going to cover a lot because we cover precepts, you know, every year, and then opening the heart. But just briefly, in terms of working with the nine fields as a whole, the way that I'm picturing that people, you know, if this appeals to them at all, to work with them, is not to essentially let them stress you out. Like, oh my God, now I got to do this, and what am I doing? Oh, what am I doing in that area? I feel like it's not meant, unless you find it helpful and you actually, you know, do want to use it to structure your practice and, you know, make vows in particular areas or something. But I guess, you know, other than maybe Zazen and Dharma study, keeping precepts, that those are like maybe like the three always ongoing ones. The other ones, like, I feel like naturally we're going to be focusing on just a couple of those at any given time based on our interest or based on what's coming up in our life. And usually, if we're exploring one field very deeply, other fields are going to arise. You know, the need to do some Dharma study about something, or the need to, you know, think about Bodhisattva activity or something like that. So in a way, I formulated them to communicate how pervasive Zen practice can be, and to remind us not to leave any essential pieces out. So in a way, just kind of knowing what the breadth can be is something we can carry with us. So in terms of precepts, we just finished our annual study of precepts on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So I probably don't need to go into lots of detail. Looks like I think everybody here is familiar with the precepts, or has taken them even. Are you familiar with the precepts? Okay, then everybody here is. Precepts, you know, have many different levels. So at the very most fundamental level, just trying to keep them keeps us from making a mess of our lives. And if you're making a mess of your life, you really can't do spiritual practice very well. So at the very basic level, it is just about not killing and stealing and abusing intoxicants and stuff like that. But of course, then, you know, at many different levels, of course, they describe enlightened behavior. So when we are inclined to break precepts, it mirrors our state of mind, and it reminds us, oh, it's a little like red flag that of self-attachment or concern. So we can use the precepts as tools for self-study. And I put them in the compassion subcategory because they could have been in skillful action, of course, but they're all about relationships. You know, the precepts are all about our relationships with other beings. So that's why I put them in a compassion category. And if we emphasize the positive side of each precept, you know, that's really something to aspire to. And I don't know, I guess I would say, sometimes in the midst of a busy, you know, ordinary daily life, precepts might be the most pervasive. I mean, would anybody agree with me, they're like the most pervasive aspect of our practice, the one that arises like kind of all day, every day. you know, pretty easy to keep in mind in a way, because, you know, indulging anger or having judgments about someone or, you know, an inclination not to speak truthfully. I mean, all this kind of stuff is just we're faced all day. So I'm guessing I don't need to say anything more about precepts as a field of practice. Any thoughts or reflections? All right. So, going on to opening the heart. So, I think we know that, like, an enlightened person feels goodwill toward other beings, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, feel a sense of intimacy and connectedness, undefendedness. And the question is, does that a result of other practices, you know, zazen and study and precepts, you know, and then your heart opens? Or do we need to work on opening the heart kind of more consciously, explicitly, and deliberately? Now, really, in Zen, we're not as explicit as some other traditions of Buddhism in terms of really working on the heart in this way. It's really more in Theravadin Buddhism or Vipassana. They have metta practice, so they concentrate on the Brahma Viharas, which are goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So they have teachings around those, and in particular, they work on metta practice. Because you start with goodwill, like, and they say compassion is when you feel goodwill toward another being, when you wish for their, you know, for them to be happy and well, and you see them suffering, compassion arises. When you feel goodwill toward a being, and you see them doing well, sympathetic joy arises. And then equanimity is, you know, another thing that we cultivate to keep all of these things in balance. But the goodwill has to be there. So really, we talk a lot about compassion, but it really has to start with the goodwill. Because, you know, compassion, supposed compassion without goodwill can just kind of be pity. So finding this entry gate of goodwill. So there's actual practices, which I imagine many of you are familiar with, of, you know, calling someone to mind and kind of mentally sending them metta, sending them goodwill. May you be at ease. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be happy. And we may do this. It's recommended that you start with somebody who's it's easy to feel that for. A child, a pet, some kind of uncomplicated relationship. And then we move on to other people for whom it's relatively easy. At some point, we include ourselves. Oftentimes, at least for Westerners, we say you have to have goodwill for yourself before you can really legitimately have goodwill for anyone else. But sometimes it's a very hard place for us to start. So actually, sometimes it's easier to generate a feeling of goodwill for someone else or for an innocent being than to turn that inward. But anyway, so there's these very explicit practices around really trying to explore your heart and notice, you know, when there's a limit to the, you know, now you call a coworker to mind and it's kind of like, you know. And we explore that internally and notice where our limits are in terms of open-heartedness. And then in the Vajrayana tradition, one of the primary kind of very basic, not an intro practice, but they visualize Avalokiteshvara, or they call that Bodhisattva Chenrezig. And so they have this visualization practice where they learn to visualize Chenrezig, and then eventually there's these different steps, and there's this step of kind of bringing Chenrezig and yourself together. So like you become the bodhisattva of compassion, So they're again working on this, which I think that's a really interesting practice, because it's, if you really explore our where our hearts are closed, sometimes our hearts are closed because of a sense of inadequacy. You know, it's actually is a sense like, well, why would anybody need my goodwill? You know, as opposed to sometimes I think, you know, everybody says the Dalai Lama is such a, you know, radiant, wonderful being. But I mean, what if you were raised from the very beginning and said, you are the Bodhisattva of compassion. We are all looking to you to be the Bodhisattva of compassion. We all probably would have been raised quite differently, you know? Like, oh, you know, rise to the task and feel capable of it. And so in some ways, that kind, it's a very interesting process of, you know, opening the heart also means self-reflection and healing and forgiveness and acceptance of ourselves. And so in Zen, a lot of times we're not as explicit about this, and I think we should be and could be. So I recommend, I can't lead chinrezig practice, but I recommend metta practice, and I'm going to talk about a couple other ways that we do work on opening the heart in Zen. And one of them is in the midst of Sangha, our relationships in Sangha. I mean, at least in Sangha, supposedly, we all have the common aspiration to take responsibility for ourselves and to open our heart. And one of the reasons I think we need to be more explicit about it in largely lay, non-residential practice is because I think Zen in its history has relied a lot on the monastic training. So in a monastery, you know, it's sometimes they describe it as a rock tumbler. You know, you take a bunch of sharp rocks and you tumble them around and they knock into each other until they, you know, all their hard edges are knocked off and they're shiny and smooth. It can be kind of a brutal process, but it's like, you know, the idea is just through our interactions with each other, if we're going to take responsibility for ourselves and stick with it and not just go like, you know, screw these people, I'm out of here, that we'll have to grow and we'll have to work through some of this stuff. So I thought I would share a story. My Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett. So this is Kyogen and Gyokuko's teacher, Jiyu Kennett. And she was an English woman. She ended up hooking up with this Japanese Zen teacher, actually quite a like high-ranking priest in Japan. And he encouraged her to come study with him. And she just did. She went to Japan, and he was the abbot of a big Soto Zen monastery that did not have Westerners at it, and especially did not have women at it. So it was like she was stuck in this really awkward position of the abbot of the monastery has invited her as his personal student. But the question of whether she would even actually be able to be admitted to the monastery was very much up in the air. So it was like this weird diplomatic dance. And she wrote an account of this called The Wild White Goose, where she tells kind of, it looks kind of like a diary, which I hear from my teachers is a little, I don't know that anything in there is false, but it's a little bit like a dramatization of what happened. So anyway, keep that in mind if you ever choose to read it. But she's described so far, up to this passage, just immense difficulty. And I don't know that they do this anymore, but, you know, in the traditional monasteries, they've taken these, like, 18, 19, 20-year-old guys, and they only have a limited time to whip them into shape, into priests. And a lot of times they didn't even want to be priests. And they were just, their fathers were priests, so they had to do it. So there was a lot of beating went on. So a lot of there's a stick, which we have on the altar, we will not use to hit anybody. It's just symbolic. But they would carry that stick around, and as you're sitting zazen, I don't know, if you're sleepy or you're not doing it right or something, you know, you'll have to lean over and they'll whack you. And I don't know. So she's all bruised and she's, I don't know. She, like, it's very, very hard. She's very determined, but, you know, in a way, like, she was an amazing person because I think most of us would have just totally been out of there, man or woman. So she's describing, she's been at the monastery for a while now, and she's still like, I don't even know if she's allowed to sit in the main zendo with people, and I don't know, she has a sense that some of the monks seem like they're out to get her. I mean, they really resent a woman being there. They resent the attention that she's getting from the abbot. So she describes, the bell went for the hour of working in the garden, and we all changed into work clothes and went out together. It has never ceased to amaze me how these old senior priests rush out to do hard work while many of the juniors have to be almost forcibly dragged. I wanted to think about the conversation we had just had. So she had accounted a conversation with one of the monks assigned to advise her. And it doesn't really matter what it is about. And being a bit annoyed with my fellow juniors, who have done very little to be friendly in the past couple of months, I went off by myself to dig up weeds instead of joining the main body, who were removing daisy roots in another part of the grounds. I was busy digging away when I suddenly discovered the chief disciplinarian digging beside me very quietly. And it seemed we were rapidly being joined by a large number of others who were digging in my daisy patch. Quite soon I realized that they had formed a circle around me and were digging inward toward the center where I was digging. Thinking that I had come to the wrong place and not wishing to cause problems, moreover, all I wanted to do right then was think, I moved on to another patch several hundred yards away. The circle converged on the center I had vacated. One set light to the pile of daisy roots and everyone dispersed. I went back to concentrating on what we had been talking about. Then I noticed that Reverend Sansaburo and Reverend Hajime were quietly working on either side of me. Opposite, some 20 yards away, was the chief disciplinarian, and before I knew it, a huge circle was formed, of which I was part. Reverend Ichiro came up to the circle and somehow fitted himself in between Reverend Hajime and I. He busily cut away at the weeds, then whispered in my ear, "You should dig deeper." At first I thought he was referring to the weeds, and then I knew that he was not. We all arrived at the center of the weed patch, more or less simultaneously, and someone thrust a box of matches into my hand. I lit the pile of weeds, and they left me to tend the fire, moving on to another patch. As soon as I had got it going, I left it and went off to another place, determined to think. But the circle formed around me again, and Reverend Hajime whispered in my ear, "Now is the time of digging up weeds, not thinking." "But how can I think whilst I dig?" I said. He produced pencil and paper. "Not if you dig properly," he wrote, because he can write English better than he can speak it. "Not if you dig properly," he wrote. "When you are digging weeds, you are digging weeds. When you are thinking, you are thinking. Right, not left, has many meanings. Also, we train together, not alone, up mountain. When one is enlightened, all is enlightened. You are trying to cut enlightenment, but it cannot be divided. We are one circle." "Not two. No one is outside Buddhism." So I heard that story many, many years ago and just never forgot it, that image of, you know, despite all of this conflict, that through this actual practice, they were finding a way together. So, you know, later on in there's a field of karma work later on, which I feel like that is where we were going to explicitly, you know, when we notice an undefended place, or we notice a defended place, we notice a closed heart. Karma work is really where we, you know, not get into analyzing it per se, but we get to know it and work on those kinds of obstacles. But this, I see the opening the heart is really more of like a positive or kind of a proactive way of opening the heart. So rather than so much concentrating on the obstacles, trying as best we can to cultivate something positive. And there are sources in Zen. So Dogen has a beautiful essay in the Shobogenzo called Shishobo, or the Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. The four methods are giving, or non-greed, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. And by identity action, which is the kind of situation I wish I could read Japanese, the non-difference from self, non-difference from others. So I see it as it's acting, but without a sense of separation from others. And one of the quotes is, foolish people think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost. But this is not so. Beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. So there are other practices. There are the paramitas, generosity, moral discipline, forbearance, diligence, meditation, wisdom, so particularly generosity. There's our bodhisattva vow. There's the beautiful Metta Sutta from the Pali Canon, which I didn't bring a bit of, but I don't know, they chanted out a great vow. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness, knows the path of peace, and you know, just describes this Buddha, you know, just like generous and kind and loving and patient and all that kind of stuff. You know, and in everyday life, it's meaning to bring practice to working on our relationships, being open-hearted with people, acceptance and true intimacy, letting go of, you know, what it is what we expect, what we really want from other people, and like, you know, who is this person really? What is real intimacy? I don't know. I think maybe it's, I guess cultures have always had ideas, but I think in particular, you know, we have books and movies, and I don't know about you, but I have this idea that I've adopted from my culture that like a good relationship involves, I don't know, if it's going to be intimate, it's got to be really explicit. Like, Zach, I really love you. I appreciate you. And you can say that back. And we can, you know, talk about our issues if we have. And it's very kind of explicit and verbal. And I don't know about you, but I don't find that most of my relationships work that way. Whether I want them to or not, they just don't. I mean, most of the people I know are just not going there. And maybe, and so I've had to ask myself, you know, in particular, you know, my relationship with my father, who I absolutely love dearly, but I kind of feel like there's something we should say, I don't know. Or there's ways that I wish we could interact and we don't. And yet I feel like as long as I am wanting it to be something other than what it is, I'm missing what is, you know, just accepting it the way it is. So that kind of stuff, and our, you know, our radical self-acceptance and healing, I think is an essential part of our practice. And I think it's beautiful. Actually, another aspect of this is, I haven't taught the Lotus Sutra yet, but eventually I'll have to. And the Lotus Sutra is, because it's long, and you know, where do you start? But I feel like one of the strongest messages of it is we all suffer from low self-esteem, which is really weird seeing as this book arose round about the beginning of the Common Era. This is an old source. And yet in it, there's these parables of people just feeling inadequate, feeling not up to the task. But having to come around to being able to see that they too can be Buddhas. And I was like, you know, wow, that is, so in a way our, you know, we, if we think of this in terms of like, I want to understand the Dharma and, you know, get better at meditation, like it's a skill or something we're doing. And yet sometimes the obstacle is not how well we understand or our skill. It's our heart, you know, it's how we hold ourselves and how we see ourselves in the world. That is the obstacle. Maybe the primary obstacle. So I guess I will leave it there and have 10 or 15 minutes for any discussion if people want.
I want to say that you said you don't emphasize compassion, love in Zen, but Mel Weitzman, was he, he said, somebody asked him, like, why don't we ever talk about love in Zen? He thought for a while and he goes, isn't that all we talk about? When you have like a koan which says, this very mind is Buddha, there is a deep reaching and validation of yourself, which is love, right? I mean, it's not, we don't have maybe metta practice and Chenrezig practice and Tongden, but in the essence, when it says this very mind is Buddha, that's kind of really deep acceptance of love. That's what I'm finding when I, because I always have this question, like, why isn't there more emphasis on it? But when he said that, I was like, think of the practice in that direction, in that light. Everything is opening you up to the love that is all around you.
That's my experience.
Yeah.
You know, and that, so in a way, it, you know, like, where is the love? It's kind of like,
what else is
it? Yeah, I mean, it's all about intimacy. It's all about, but you know, I mean, I guess if people are asking sometimes, and maybe it's not quite as explicit as they.
I think it takes a while to get there too, right? In the beginning, you might need more directed kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask this, Dumya. In English, we use the word love. And in Latin and Greek, they have a plethora of words. Is there a similar existence of the vocabulary in Japanese?
I don't know, because they don't really ever mention love. So I'm not, I don't know. In terms of like, well, I don't know about the, you know, so I said like in Zen, we don't, there's not so much of it, but if you were to look at the words for the Brahma Viharas, you know, goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, I've definitely, I mean, goodwill is sometimes translated as loving kindness, and sometimes just as love, but I don't know, in our, it's true, we could use more words in English, because love to me is a, carries a little bit of a sentimental, romantic baggage with it, which, I don't know, maybe that's not a bad thing, but I don't know, they, I don't know, just because we're talking about this right now, it makes me think of, there's a song by Leonard Cohen. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Leonard Cohen, and he spent a long time in a monastery, and then he came out, and his first album when he came out was 10 new songs. And one song on there, I read as a description of an awakening experience, and it's called Love Itself Is Gone. And he describes being in a room and like seeing the sunlight come in and the dust is, you know, dancing. And he just has, you know, some, he said, I was tumbled up with them, you know, a moment of just non-separation from all of it. And he just said, and then love even like slipped out through an open door or something. Love itself was gone, because, you know, the love, as we usually conceive of it, takes separation. I'm over here, I love. And when that separation is gone, then in a way that doesn't even apply. So I think that's why Zen kind of avoids using the term love.
Intimacy.
Yeah. Although, you know, it doesn't exclude love. It's just this is something even subtler.
I guess what I was trying to get at was other traditions use agape as a form of, you know, brotherly love.
I think you're thinking of phileo, not agape.
Yeah, agape is much bigger than brotherly love.
Okay, I don't have the definitions correct then. I'm sorry.
What is agape then?
Agape is more love, compassion. Filial, Dan was just saying, is more brotherly love.
Yeah, that's that was my understanding. As opposed to amore, which is much more of that sexual attraction.
Yeah, so I mean, definitely the Buddhist stuff would be more like agape or...
And filios?
You know, yeah. That's sort of a brotherly love.
But how is that different from agape?
I think agape is more divine love.
Yes.
I think
filios
is brotherly love.
Okay.
Eros is the sexual.
Right.
Sexual. Yeah.
Are we just switching between Latin and Greek here? Is that what's happening?
Oh, actually, let go. Well, so I'm talking Greek. There's three words.
Yeah.
Okay. I was using Latin, and that's probably... We're not talking about six different things here.
Right. Sorry.
Yeah.
When you... even Shintai, the talks... Here we go again. My heart's just in a meltdown. Last Sunday was there was one time I was at Sushin and I was working in the kitchen and then I seen Hogan and I don't know what he said, but something. And so I was in this place of great self-righteous judgments, like shoot. And I kept, and then because for the silence, which was such a gift, I was the only one who had to deal with it was me. And there's a chant that we say there, this Buddha receives only compassion.
Mm.
And that chant kept coming up, and then I just burst out laughing, and everything just like flipped. It was just like, oh, this is such a compassionate thing that just happened. And all the judgment just went poof.
Mm.
And it was, it's happened several times in Sushin where it's just like, oh yes, this Buddha, here, this Buddha receives only compassion and everything that I just experienced. And I was like, no. And it was just, I saw it and received it and experienced and felt it deep inside from a totally, as a compassionate gift that I've been given.
That is really cool that says this Buddha, it's not this Buddha sends out only compassion. This Buddha receives only compassion.
Yeah.
I got a compassion filter. It's only the compassion's coming through. Nice.
Do you interpret that as being a filter? Stuff comes to me, but I don't look at compassion through it. Or do you see that as everything that comes to me without filtering is compassion?
There's no filter.
Yeah.
The filter is the garbage.
I'm always struck by how this, you know, the fruits of practice, the realizations that we want to have, the liberation that Buddhism offers ends up being so personal. It's so easy to be sitting here and like, look, you know, we don't even realize it in a subtle way. We're looking out there. What is true? What is compassion? What is emptiness? What is whatever? What is Buddha nature? But it's kind of like, you know, some of the more rude Zen masters will be like, it's about you, stupid. You know, like it's like it's, you know, it ends up being like, well, me. You know, it's like,
I remember being deeply moved during a Dharma talk by Gyokaku, where somehow she made the point, like this whole list of ancestors, and I think we were focusing on one of the ancestor stories and how they, you know, awakened and whatever. And somehow she, I can't remember what she said, but she just really got across, like, they were like us. They were no different than you. It just kind of clicked, you know? And I just sat there with tears rolling down my face, realizing not that I really believed I was like them yet, but what I recognized was I thought, I'm not like them. I recognized that belief that I was holding and needed to somehow find a way to let go, that I'm not me. I'm not included in this club. I'm flawed or incomplete or whatever.
So there's this, the koan, you know, the, I was just reading, listening to a talk where it says, this very mind, one, a student asks his teacher, what is Buddha? And he says, this very mind is Buddha. But if someone says that, shut your eyes and run, close your ears and run away, you know, or rinse your mouth out. So it's like, don't make it into something, because express it in how you are, instead of making it into, like, this very mind. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
It is so hard. It's so hard not to.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I admit I'm intellectual. Mm-hmm. Some of us admit we're intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all intellectual. We're, you know, even if you don't think of yourself as all that smart, or you don't like reading or whatever.
Yeah.
It's still we still grasp it with our minds and like, okay, you know. It's really difficult not to. That is what we depend on. We think we need. That is how we understand the world and control things and predict things and know who we are and. It takes a while to gain the courage and willingness and determination to experiment with letting go of that to some extent. Well, thank you.
Thank you.